welcome everybody. This is Winfrey, and this is our Monday night conference call, simulcast on BBS Radio. And my co-host, Terry Brown, are you there, Terry?
Yes, I am. I'm here.
I hear you. And,
good.
We're just going to do a little intro because we announced that this call comes on at 6 p.m. PST. So we have about 3 minutes. So before we officially start, just let people check into our conference call into BBS Radio. We're going to have a very interesting topic tonight. As some of you know, if you've listened to our shows before, there's the underlying theme of what I call interdimensional communications and the potential contribution to this realm from sources that identify themselves as group souls in other realms, and that have the ability to link in not just with verbal messages, but with energies. Many people on our calls reported that can feel. And this only happens to that. Otherwise, you can just listen from your mental level. When you hear those beeps like that, that means somebody is checking into our conference line. Would you like to say your name and your city?
Hi, Gwen. It's Diane in Minnesota.
Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Which city in Minnesota?
Clearwater.
Is that near Hibbing?
No. No, we're just south of St. Cloud, close
uh-huh.
to St. Cloud.
Hibbing is my main town that I visited in Minnesota when I was younger, and I went to visit Bob Dylan's parents. So,
yes, I heard that story, and it's a good town, isn't it?
Yes, I love your accent. People are checking in, I'm going to turn it back to Hives, who is our official leader. And go ahead, Hives.
All right, I want to say a warm welcome to everybody who joined us. We had three more people just join us in the last minute. Will you please say your name and city?
Hi, Lisa from San Francisco.
Good evening.
Lisa. Hi.
Hi, this is Edna from Sohomish, Washington.
Guten Abend, Edna, we gave.
Guten Abend, geht's ganz gut, danke.
All right. And the third person, if the third person also wants to say name and city. But not necessarily. Welcome to the call anyway, and with the mic back to you.
Right? It's 7 o'clock, so we'll officially start our call in about a minute. And I'd just like to welcome everyone that's listening on BBS Radio all over the world. People are listening to our calls and our replays. And I want to thank everyone who emailed about what they experienced. Now, part of the way we validate what we're doing is from the way it impacts people. Like if a tree falls in the forest, is there any sound? An old Zen riddle. Is there sound when a tree falls? This only means something because of people that are connecting with it. Go ahead, Hive. I'll turn it back to you.
Welcome to the person who just joined us. Welcome to the conference call at BBS. Please say your name and city.
Hi, it's Colleen in Vancouver.
Colleen from Vancouver. Good evening, Colleen. Welcome to the BBS call.
Thank you.
Hi, this is from South Dakota.
Is this Jean? South Dakota?
Yes.
All right, Jean, good evening. Welcome to the call.
Thank you.
And the next person who joined.
Zoe, Sacramento.
Good evening, Zoe.
Hi, guys. How are you? Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Hi.
And there was another person who joined us in the last minute. Welcome to the call. Please say your name and city.
Carrie L., Jerome, Arizona.
Ariel, good evening. How are you doing?
I'm very good.
All right. Welcome to the call. Vin, back to you.
Ariel. Ariel. Ariel, are you in Jerome?
Yes.
Is that Ariel who I know with Glenn?
It's Carrie-L. No, I don't think you know me.
Hi, Carrie-L. All right.
Hi.
Is this your first time on the line?
Oh, no. I used to listen a lot in a year or so ago.
I love Jerome.
Yeah. Well, I lived in Sedona for a couple years.
Mm-hmm. You know, Jerome is a little town up in the mountains, way up high, and just Ian Turney Road. It's about, I guess, about 15 miles, no, about 20 miles from Sedona.
It takes about 40 minutes because I lived in Sedona and worked there, so I know it takes about 40 minutes by car.
It's such a cool little town. It's like the whole town is built on this twisty road going up a mountain, and it used to be an old mining town, and everything in it is quaint. Right.
Yeah, it's the third after Sedona and the Grand Canyon visited. It's Grand Canyon, Sedona, Jerome.
Huh?
And amount of people visit. They start with the Grand Canyon, then they go to Sedona, then it's Jerome.
One day. One day I'm going to take my computer up to Jerome and go to that old hotel at the top of the hill and just work all day. My agenda.
Is that the Asylum?
Asylum? Is that the name of the hotel?
The one way at the top that used to be the hospital?
I think so, yeah. Mm-hmm. These great views looking down.
There's a lot of orbs. People take a lot of pictures of orbs there.
Yeah. Well, I was there one time, and it was very magical. But in any case, anyone just check in that would like to say hello?
Yeah. Hey, Wynn, it's Chris in Memphis.
Hi, Chris.
Hey, man.
Anyone else? Okay. I'm going to mute everybody.
All callers are muted, and they can unmute themselves. Entry and exit chimes are off.
And this is Monday, January 31st, and we announced an interesting topic tonight. I think it was called What to Do When You're Going to Die or something like that. And, you know, it's not something that many people talk about, although there are people that specialize in that, hospices, people that visit people that are dying. And over the period of time, then we've talked to our sources and we've talked about death. They think of it as just a transition and that we're going to continue and we're going to come back and have more lifetimes. And it's no big deal. This is one lifetime in many. Of course, when you're in this realm, the way they describe it is that the illusion of this realm makes us think that when our body disappears, that maybe we are no more. And then, of course, the other question is, if we do continue, where do we go? And, of course, religions say that there's heaven and hell and there's all these different places. And we really can't know how it really works in this realm because we can't see those other realms. And last week, we had an experience where someone passed away who was someone I would call him a friend, and Terry was very, very close friend to him. And he's one of those people, I'll tell you a little bit about him. Are you there, Terry? Terry?
Yeah.
Okay. Hopefully we won't start crying in this show, but if we do, just forgive us, because it's part of the grief that all of us experience when somebody disappears. And of course, maybe the grief is not just because they died, but because the way that they contributed to us while we were alive is no longer going to be contributed. And so if somebody meant something to us, then we lose that contribution in this realm. And so grief is part of that. And how much do prayers work? How much does being with them when they die? What should we be thinking when we're about to die? We're all going to die. No matter how much we talk about making our life more successful in this realm and more joyous, which are all very good goals, this is something that should be of interest to everybody, to know how to die and what creates a better death. So the gentleman's name is John Sanborn, and John and Terry have been friends for probably, how many years, Terry?
Since about 1972.
And John was a writer, and he was one of those people that was, I put him in the category of being like a classical poet. Like at one point he was became friends with Robert Frost, and Robert Frost accepted him, not as an equal, but as someone that he had some respect.
John used to go to Breadloaf, and I believe Robert Frost had something to do with Breadloaf, which I believe is a school. And John used to go up to Robert Frost's cabin. And Robert Frost made a poem for John. And he wrote it in the front of one of his poetry books. And he gave it to John. I think that poem is now part of the main body of work of Robert Frost. And John loved jazz, and he knew a lot of the top jazz performers, including Steve Hofstadter, who has a 19-piece for soul band, and he plays for clubs and restaurants around Pasadena area, and he has records out. Steve Hofstadter, jazz musician extraordinaire. And so where John lived, sometimes somebody would be playing music and all that, like rock or something, and all that would come through to John's little trailer was woom, 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 woom. And he couldn't hear the highs or anything. And John said he'd rather die than listen to that music. And it didn't go on all the time. He lived in a really beautiful little place by the creek, Oak Creek. And he was very loving person, and he had a full range of emotional tones. So he could get angry, or he could get lovable, or he could get joyous, or he could get sad and griefy. And he had a history of where he was in the Navy on PT boat 77. And about a week and a half ago, he told me about the story about how when he was on the PT boat, the PT boat was bombed. It was actually friendly fire, and he was badly injured with a lot of bomb fragments in his neck and in his leg. And somebody said, "Don't mind him, he's dead." And then somebody else came around later, and John said, he was still alive. He said to them, "I'm not going to open my eyes unless you promise to take us back to land." So they used to, they took him back to land. They took the boat back, and they put him in the hospital there on the shore. And the kamikaze planes called the PT boats the devil boats. And they would send the kamikaze planes on suicide missions to attack the boat, to dive bomb into them, to destroy them. And when they would do that, Sandy Tredinnick was the skipper, and John might be in the wheelhouse. And Sandy and John had a strategy for avoiding the collision with the kamikaze plane, the Zero plane, and it would be aimed straight at their boat. And when they would turn the boat toward the plane and sit there idle in the water until the plane was totally committed and couldn't change its course, and then they'd flip the wheel around and the plane would go into the water next to the boat. And this was a very good way of avoiding getting hit by a kamikaze plane. Well, after John got bombed by friendly fire, he said friendly fire was hard because you couldn't shoot back because it was our plane. And they had gone out in the water during this big battle, and the planes, it was a cross communication. The planes had the order to shoot everything out of the water that was out there. And one plane came over, and on the radio, the plane said, "Is that a little martini boat down there?" And the boat radio operator said, "Yes." And he said, "Get out of there. We've got orders to shoot everything out of the water down there." And then the second plane came along and bombed them. Well, so they took the boat back, repaired it, and put John in the hospital. Then they sent the boat back out. And the PT boat, PT-77, were out to sea, and a kamikaze plane came a little too close. And all the whole crew realized that they were going to get hit. And so they all jumped overboard. And they were all saved. Well, John heard the announcement from the hospital that the PT boat 77 was hit. And so he thought all of his friends were dead. And so he was going away to get some food at the canteen. And he came back to the hospital, and when he walked in the hospital, he said all 15 of the guys from the PT-77 boat were in the hospital there, and they were all beaming at him because he thought they were all dead, and they were all beaming because they had something over on them because they'd all survived. And so he when he told me that a couple weeks ago, he was just crying because he was so happy to see all those guys, that they had survived. So he heard a lot of good stories about his times He had a lot of good friends and a lot of good memories. He was responsible for a lot of the books that were published and edited in Scientology. He had put together the 08 book, and he put together the Auditor series, the Red on White. He put together the Admin series, the Administration series, and he had added lots of the books and gotten a whole crew together to help edit and to publish books. He went to England and Scotland and worked with the organization in publishing books. He was a really extraordinarily good writer. And when I edited...
He actually read The Reincarnation of Edgar Cayce when we were doing it, and added his own thoughts about it. I think we took some of his thoughts and made some changes, didn't we?
Yeah, we did. Like, there would be a whole paragraphs, like, at the beginning or other parts of the book where they didn't seem to hang together right, and I'd take them to John, and I'd read them to him, and John would either make suggestions on how to make them better, or he'd say, trash the whole thing and start over. because there's nothing to work with.
I would say that when we were writing that book, you know, John is an extraordinary writer, and I guess part of what he wanted was to be successful as a writer himself, and he never became that, except perhaps for the stuff he did with Ron Hubbard. And I'm not a Ron Hubbard supporter, but John actually put his heart into that and was there at the very beginning of that organization and probably made quite a difference in the way it grew. And John was a genius in his own way. And in recent times, he was living in Sedona, and he was living here because Terry moved him here, and he's 88 years old. And basically living kind of as a recluse, and every day his main thing was to go to the health food store, and he became friends with all the employees, like this knurly guy who would walk through the store, and everyone knew him. He cut a very striking, energetic image, and he worked really... He created a lot of affinity with the people there. Now, Terry had the idea that John might have been Socrates in one of his lifetimes, because a lot of his philosophy, things that he would say, were very similar to Socrates. And Socrates had a similar aspect to him, where he was very much a loner. And he would go, if he's ever read the history of Greece and Athens, he would go into the public places and schmooze with the people in public places. And he would kind of get a following. He would sit down, I guess, at the cafes or wherever people could sit down. And young people would sit down around him. And he would kind of just engage them in such a way as force himself to make wise observations in their lives. And he never wrote anything, except Plato was one of the young people, and Plato then wrote about Socrates after Socrates died. And of course, Socrates died because he was corrupting the youth, and he was... He was accused of corrupting the youth, and the state poisoned him. And his students wanted to save him, but he wouldn't allow himself to be saved. He said, well, I'm going to follow the law. If they want me to die, then fine. And for a period, I thought Terry was just off the deep end. But then when I got to know John better, in Sedona, and getting to know John was quite a challenge for me, getting him to like me or getting us to connect with each other was a challenge, because for a good period of our knowingness, he felt competitive with me because I was getting a book published and he had always wanted to be recognized, and so he dealt with me kind of adversarially. And
I don't think that that was the reason why.
Because I was obnoxious.
That was part of the reason he felt that.
Because I was obnoxious.
Right. That was the main reason.
I didn't know how to create a common ground with John. And, of course, we were doing all this metaphysical stuff, and I didn't know. But one time I went over to his house, and in his older age he was getting senile, and his memory was getting defective. And he was reading me something he wrote, and we had talked about the interdimensional stuff that was happening between Terry and myself, and he would always refer to it as the sky people. What are the sky people saying? And then he was reading something he wrote, and in the middle of it, there's this one sentence that said, "I'm not Ra unless you are too." And I said, "What was that?" And he looked at me confused. He didn't know where that came from. Well, obviously, they made a connection with him. And somehow, in the recesses of his unconscious, that sentence came through. And they were trying to tell him, one of the things that people think when they think of sources in other realms is they think they're giving up their power. There's going to be some huge source that's going to tell you what to do. And people like John and even myself are very, how can I say it, self-propelled, you know, don't want anything to have authority over us. And it took me a while to realize that they did not want to have authority over me or anyone else. They just wanted to help us from their realm. So they were kind of, somehow they found a space in John's consciousness to bring that message through. I'm not Ra unless you are too. And I think that's true for everyone listening. These guys are us. The universe is one energy. And that when you can connect to the oneness of everything, you realize that it's just an expanded part of you. And some of you, you can say that in your mind, but some of you have actually had the experience and understand that that's the case, that you've learned to have these energetic friends in other dimensions. And so I was like blown away when John read me that. And then, you know, over the past months, we had actually made a good connection. I would, you know, Terry would probably go over and visit him. She'd talk to him an hour a day. I wasn't like controlling that connection or that relationship. I wanted her to actually connect with him. And in fact, I started calling him and saying, "How's it going, John? What's going on?" And and I was really enjoying the connection. And then last week, I had called John just to check on him, and there was no answer. And usually when there was no answer, then he was in the health food store. So I was in the coffee shop next door to the health food store, and I went over to the health food store, and he wasn't there. And I called Terry, and I said, "I think something's wrong. John's not home, and he's not in the health food store." And what happened was he was leaving his little complex. He was living in a little trailer park complex, and he hit a building driving out. We don't know why. Either he went unconscious, or something went wrong with the car, or he stepped on the gas instead of the brake. and he hit the building, and the seatbelt broke three of his ribs. And the next thing we know, he's in the hospital in Flagstaff, which is 30 miles from here. And Terry went there and started doing a vigil with him. And what Terry experienced is the reason I decided to make this the topic of this call. There we go. I got some tears. And Terry, do you want to share that? I'm just gauging the time. It's 7:32. By the way, somebody emailed me and they said, last week I cut Terry off because we were going to do a channeling and we only had a few minutes left. And so if anyone thinks that I cut her off because I was being rude, I'm sorry that I gave that idea. But I know people look forward to hearing messages from the sky people on these calls. And so that's why I did it. I apologize to Terry and anyone who thought that that was impolite. In any case, I'm not going to cut you off, Terry. Although,
all right.
If you feel like we can do a channeling about this, and if not, you know, we have about 7:33, we have about 20 minutes left. Why don't you tell people what happened and what you experienced in the hospital in Flagstaff?
Okay, well, it's called Flagstaff Medical Center, and I went up there. The police wouldn't talk to anybody except Jane, who is John's daughter, and so they called Jane, and Jane said she was going to fly in, but I went up there, and I got there. I wanted to go that night. However, and I was getting stuff ready to go. However, by that time, it was probably 11:45 at night. The accident happened about 4, and I found out about it about 6. And so I was still getting ready to go up there, but it seemed so dark and so late at night that it seemed like I shouldn't be driving that far, and it might be unsafe to drive up there alone, the lonely roads. So I waited until next day, and I got up there, and John was still on the breathing tube, and they said he had stabilized. He came in critical, but then he had stabilized. So they had him in intensive care, and they had him all hooked up to all of these monitors that monitored his heart, his heart rate, his blood pressure. There was about 12 things that they were monitoring. And so I talked to the nurse and said that they were going to try and take out the breathing tube and have him breathe on his own. So he couldn't really talk, but he was very alert. And I had brought some papers with me for his insurance policy that he had to sign. So I talked to him, and he first of all he wanted a piece of paper. He couldn't talk because of breathing tube and stuff. So he made a motion of writing, like he wanted me to give him a pen and a surface to write on it and some paper. So I got him that, and he wrote, "Tell me," like, "Tell me what happened." So he wrote, "Tell me," on the paper. And so I told him what I knew of what had happened. And then the bunch of nurses came in, and they were going to take out the breathing tube, and they were joking with him. After they took out the breathing tube, he started to be able to talk. And they said, "Okay, we're gonna like he had knocked out his lower teeth and his jaw, like his lower lip had been cut, like as he hit the steering wheel. He, in the accident, he'd hit the building, and actually the bumper had gone through a 6-inch cement wall, and his face hit the steering wheel, and the safety belt broke his ribs. So he was having a hard time breathing because his ribs were in the wrong place. They were dislocated. And so they had wired his jaw, wired his teeth back in, and wired his jaw. But so he was starting to be able to talk. And I had him sign the papers before they took out the breathing tube, and he was like guiding me to guide his hand to know where to start writing, and he wrote his name on through the papers. And then I went during the rest time when the place was closed to visitors. I went and I faxed him to the insurance company, and then I went back. But in the afternoon before the rest time, the three nurses came in and they said, "All right, we want to clean up your chin." And he says, "Why?" And they said, "Because you're ugly. And we want to clean the blood off your chin." He says, "I don't care if I'm ugly." And then they were moving him around in the bed, and he said, "Why are you doing that?" And they said, "Because we want to get some blood circulating through your butt." And he says, "Oh, you like bloody butts." And, you know, he was just this humor. And they turned to me and said, is this normal behavior for him? And I said, yes. And so they were talking, and he was using very big words with them, which he always does. I mean, he had a huge vocabulary and a genius IQ. And so one nurse said, "Wow, he has a really big vocabulary." And by this time, his daughter Jane had arrived. And Jane said, "Yes, he's one of the smartest men I ever met." And so he was joking around. Since he was doing that joking with the nurses and stuff, I thought, wow, you know, this is a really good sign. And everybody was figuring he was stabilizing and he was going to make it through this and heal. So I told him, I said, "Your job is to heal." And it's like he was taking instructions. He was following the instructions and nodding that he understood them and stuff. And he did say, you know, he said, "Don't you guys have any pain medication?" And they said, "You're on pain medication." And he said, "Doesn't your pain medication work?" And so they upped his pain medication until they reached a point where he wasn't in pain anymore. But that made him groggy, and he kind of slept a lot. So the next day, he was alert in the morning, and Jane was with him all morning. And in the afternoon, he became unresponsive. And so then all the monitors and everything showed that he wasn't expelling the air. And his CO2 rate, his body was not getting enough oxygen because it wasn't expelling the CO2. And he couldn't breathe deep enough to get the air out to, because of the broken ribs. They were just moved right into the middle of his chest. And so the hospital gave us, like, when I went back, Jane told me that the hospital had indicated it was bad news, that he wasn't going to make it. And they gave him 24 to 48 hours, that his body was shutting down. His liver was shutting down. His kidneys were shutting down. And his heart was beating irregularly, which had been a problem, too, before the accident. He had noticed that and asked me about it, had me feel his pulse. So So then they moved, they took him off the breathing stuff. They had him on oxygen. They took him off the oxygen mask, put in a breathing tube. But they asked him at one point if he wanted to be resuscitated, which would involve surgery and draining the liquids from his lungs because his lungs were filling with liquids. And he thought about it a long time, and then he said, no, he didn't want to be resuscitated. So then they moved him to a beautiful room overlooking Twin Peaks, snow-covered peaks in Flagstaff. And so he had a bed there, and I stayed all night that night in the hospital, and they were really sweet. It's like they brought me breakfast in the morning, and Jane came back in the morning, and they brought us a couple of big Starbucks coffees. And Jane was joking at first with her dad, you know, seeing, what are these tubes? They're giving you a milkshake and coffee through these tubes. And she was joking with him. Okay, Dad, let me wheel you down the quarters, and we can say hello to people, and we can take all this equipment with us, all these monitors and all these wires, although it might be quite difficult. And John said he didn't want to do that, and Jane said she did. She thought it would be fun, so she was joking with him. She has a good sense of humor, too. So when we got over to the other room, they took him off the monitors, and they would just come in every 4 hours or so and just take his blood pressure and check him out and turn him so he didn't get bed sores and stuff. And so they gave him 48 hours. And so at one point, I lowered his pain medication with him so that he would be able to be responsive and talk, because he didn't think he'd be responsive on that heavy dose of pain medication. So they lowered it, but then he became uncomfortable and in pain again, so Jane had him raise it again. I had him raise it some, and then Jane had him raise it more, I think. So then Jane and I were talking about what can be done or how we would handle it when he died. And at first he had kicked us out of the room when we were talking, but later on we were talking in the room and he was pretty unconscious. But I sensed that he was hearing everything. And I told Jane, I thought that he was hearing everything we were saying. And sometimes one of the workers pointed out that when people die, they leave, like when the family goes to get a bite to eat, or they leave the room for a minute, then the person takes that minute to slip out and leave. So Jane and I were talking, and I noticed that John had stopped breathing. And so I pointed that out to Jane. And Jane had been, just before he stopped breathing, for about 3 days, every time Jane was with him, she was holding his hand, and she was telling him she loved him, and he was saying he loved her. And like at one point, the first day she got there, he was like, Jane, Jane. And he was so happy to see her. And so I was holding his other hand. And I was telling him also that I loved him. And he told me, like, that he never said before, he said he loved me. And so he was feeling a very loving surroundings. He wasn't in pain. And the nurses were being very friendly to him. And it was a very loving environment. And he just opened up with responding with love. And so then when he left his body, I had noticed just probably an hour or so before, that there was this huge angel that had come and was just checking things out. And it was huge because John's a big man. He's 6'1". And this is a huge angel with huge wings, and he, it's like bigger than John. And so he was just checking things out. And so after he stopped breathing, Jane said, "Do you see the angels?" And I looked, and the huge angel was there. So I spotted John, and he was out of his body. And I said, "Let the angel guide you to the portal for the tunnel of light." And so and at one point I said, "Don't give the angels any trouble." Anyway, I was right with him. And so he was in front of me. The angel was first guiding John to the tunnel of light. And then I was behind John, making sure he found it. And so we went, so we found the tunnel, the portal to the other side. We found it. And John went, followed the angel in, and I followed John in to the tunnel of light. And I wanted to make sure that he made it. And so he was up ahead of me, and I was observing the tunnel. It was like lights, and the lights were sending energies of different frequencies through me, that a kind of a clearing energy, a kind of a changing my energy and translating that energy to a higher frequency. And John was in front of me, and he said, I said to him, I said, "Go find Robert Frost." And Jane said, "Go find the Poetry Corner." And I said, "And go find your jazz friends. Go find Billie Holiday." And I said, "Go find your friends from PT Boat 77. And he started to get really excited about seeing them because he dearly loved these people. And so he looked back and he said, "Would I be okay?" That he didn't want to leave me here because he wanted to make sure I was okay. And he was worried that I might not be okay. And so I said, "I'm going to be okay." And he said, he was still doubtful about it, and he was kind of hesitating in the tunnel of light. And I said, "I'm going to be okay." And he kind of had doubts about it, but I assured him several times, and I kept indicating, "Go find your jazz friends." And he was getting really excited about seeing his friends. And finally, he asked me one time more, "Are you going to be okay?" And I said, "Yes." And so he just went forward. And I, at that point, I had to get out of the tunnel of light because I was starting to get disoriented. And so I went back out of the tunnel, and he went forward. And then Jane and I looked, and the connection between John and I and Jane was getting thinner and thinner as he moved on the tunnel of light. And so then he was gone, and I went in, and we told the nurse, and the nurse came in, and so we could stay as long as we wanted. And then the coroner came in, and they put the body in a body bag and got it ready to take away. But there was no life left, and his body was turning pale. And so we didn't, for a couple of days, it's like Jane and I couldn't feel him, like the thread was gone. And then yesterday Wynn and I were listening to songs where these songs were choosing a song to send out to one of the spirit channels or to send out to people on the mailing list. And John, and there was a song from West Side Story, which I really love it. It's like somewhere there's a place for us. But then there was another song, We Shall Be Released, and Wynn played it. And it started to seem really, really slow. And I could hardly stand listening to it because it was so slow. And I noticed a light around me. And a very high frequency. And Wynn said, John's beaming down on you. And then I looked, and it's like John had been, like he was up there in a viewing window open from the higher heavenly realm down to here. And there was John, and there was a couple of his friends in the room.
Seth is going to cut us off any moment.
Okay, okay. I'll wrap it up.
Mm-hmm. And 753.
The frequencies were extraordinarily high, and John had translated into higher frequencies, and the whole thing was higher frequencies, and time here seemed very slow compared to time there, so that's why the songs seemed so slow. And so that's essentially what happened.
All right. You know what? Next week, we're going to do a channeling and ask how that looked from the other side and how that worked. And I think that it was, we decided in talking about this, that if Terry wasn't there, that he may have just gone up to the astral, and that the fact that someone was there helping him and loving him made him go higher than he might have gone if he died alone. I think that's one of the important things. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you next time, Wednesday, Sunday, whenever. And thanks for, Terry, thanks for sharing your experience with John. And maybe we'll send a picture of John to everyone on the Spirit Channel so they can see what he looked like. And good night. Thank you so much. Thank everybody. I thank everyone for listening tonight. And Wednesday night, we have our question and answer session. So feel free to ask a question, questions@messageday.net. And we'll see you next time. Thanks for participating.